and just kept walking. He would be walking around smoking cigarettes, getting bagels, and no one batted an eye. You know why? Because it made sense. It was what he was supposed to look like. Dick Stockton, you can do the same thing. It's time. The cat's out of the bag, and it's on your head. Show up to the next game for TNT in your jammies and cotton white slippers you find in the bedding section of Nordstrom's and get your fucking soul in sync. That Brooks Brothers suit doesn't look comfortable. And that now you see it, now you don't comb over is worrisome. I love you, Dick. Please. Listen, let me keep it real for a minute. I have struggled with my own hair shit. I know what it is to worry that it's all going away. I too have felt the beginnings of male pattern baldness. I've run my fingers through my hair and thought, where the fuck did it all go? I've taken pills and potions and dyes and dips just to keep my shit intact. It's part of the game out here in Hollywood. I mean, you think it's a coincidence that 10 of the top 10 Hollywood stars all have their hair? Take it from me, kids. There ain't no coincidences at the Hollywood Hair Club for Men. And I'm not here to name names, George, Brad, Ben, or Matt, but things can't be that fucking good for you guys. You can't be that talented, that rich, and naturally all have your hair at 45 plus. Not all of you motherfuckers. No way. That shit just doesn't work that way, especially you, George. I know. I would bet my ass that before bed, you gotta lay down that perfect bird's nest on the end table. I mean, when was the last time you saw a gigantic trillion-dollar grossing movie star go bald? It doesn't happen. Case closed. But this ain't about movie stars. This is about one-of-a-kind talents with one-of-a-kind voices who should work until the wheels fall off. Marv Albert is 75, and he's not replaceable. The man owns the word yes. You can never have another broadcaster say yes when Steph Curry makes a rainbow three-pointer. Only Marv Albert can do that. Only Hubie Brown and Mike Fratello could riff on the air and go on and on about the brilliance of Pete Maravich and the time Pistol Pete and Dr. J played one-on-one during ABA practices. They were there. They can't be replaced. These guys are sports icons. Why am I the only one bringing up the problem? Why am I the only one who it seems to bother so badly? Why am I the only one who's so damn offended by these wacky wigs and these horrendous horse hair pieces? I shouldn't be alone here, people. I want you guys to be offended, and I want you guys to get upset, too. Fuck the wigs. Fuck the plugs, man. You don't need them. We are so lucky to still have you calling games, telling stories, and sharing your life and point of view. So stand up and get mad. Be fed up and take a stand on live TV. The next time your no good hotshot 29-year-old director in his three-piece clown suit yells, action, you say, fuck you and this wig. I'm done. I'm done, fucko. Now take this ridiculous-looking animal fur off my perfectly shaped yet slightly dented head. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm better than this wig, and I'm better than this oversized suit that doesn't fit. I want you guys to look into the camera and tell the world, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not gonna wear this anymore. I want you to throw that fucking pig wig down and tell your producer to get you a ginger ale, a toasted English muffin, and get the fuck out of your face. Then say it again and say it loud, boys. I am mad as hell, and I'm not gonna wear this anymore. For the record, I can't be sure if all these guys wear toupees. And if I'm wrong, I'm sorry, fellas. About the state of your hair. Huh. I truly love all of you guys. Bill Russell is overrated. Deal with it. Listen, if you think Bill Russell is the best NBA player ever, then skip this chapter because I'm here to tell you he ain't. I'm sorry. But your hero, Bill Russell, is not the best. And he's not the second best. And no, he's not even the third best. As a matter of fact, he doesn't even make the Rappaport top 10. Don't get mad at me. It's not my fault that your parents and grandparents have been selling you this shit the same way they sold you on cod liver oil being good for you, when in fact, no one knew what the fuck cod liver oil was. And I know you're thinking that this is coming from the bitter soul of a lifelong disgruntled Knicks fan, but that's not it. Am I a bitter Knicks fan? Without a doubt. Is it difficult to sleep at night knowing that the Knicks were cursed by some unknown powers and that they may never be great again in my lifetime? Yes. Does it stick me? like a chubby pig before he says goodbye to Earth, that the team I love could lose to a high-level college team? Yes, it does. It hurts. It all hurts. The orange and blue that pumps through my veins is cold, distorted, and angry, and ready to have me cancel my NBA package altogether. But hear ye, court is in session. Bill Russell is simply over-fucking-rated. Listen, I sleep well at night knowing that the first team to beat the Celtics in a Game 7 at the original Boston Garden was my 1973 Knicks. I feel good that in the Eastern Conference Finals, my childhood heroes went on to win our last NBA title with the most talented team ever assembled. So don't worry about me. And I'm not denying Bill Russell dominated his era. I'm just saying you must look at the big picture. You have to look at the kindergartners he was playing against and rethink if he was actually great at basketball or if everyone around him just sucked. It's true. Bill Russell is the winningest athlete in basketball history. This is something I found out while fact-checking against my will. He's also an 11-time NBA champion, but it all happened when everyone else was slow and broken. He was shattering records against men who went on to become butchers and orthodontists, who played basketball for side money and all looked like my uncles. Russell's stats don't match the world he was living in. Sorry. Bill Russell was a 5-time NBA MVP. Very impressive. A stat that can't be debated, debunked, or denied. But what can be brought up is the fact that the guy with the next highest votes was Maury Feinberg, my dad's foot doctor who went on to become the corned beef distribution king of New York. Not a Hall of Fame inductee. R.I.P. to Maury and everyone who died from sodium in the 60s. Sorry, Bill Russell. It was the era, not the skills. Yes, Bill Russell was a 12-time NBA All-Star. That's nothing to scoff at. That's not an easy feat. For 12 years to be one of the best in the NBA is very real and extremely difficult. You have to be at the top of your game every night and every city, and he did it at the highest level. But you know what's even more impressive to me? Bruce Jenner won the decathlon, then went home and put on a dress while everyone else was in an ice bath. Why are we not talking about that greatness? That's a fucking feat. Bill Russell was named to the first ever NBA All-Defensive Team in 1969. The historical Russell was known for his game-changing defense as depicted in this photograph. For those of you just reading the audiobook, you could see Bill Russell jumping 3 feet off the ground, blocking the shot of a guy who appears to be 6 feet and scared to death. Get the hardcover or softcover books now. Anyway, Bill Russell was the NBA rebounding champion in 57, 58, 59, 64, and 1965. He was crashing boards and breaking records and doing things no one had done before him. He could jump higher than everyone he battled in the paint. No one even came close. You know why? Because they weren't full grown yet. You want to break rebounding records? Play against guys before they hit puberty. Come and see me play against my teenage sons and his friends. I do it every week. It makes me feel good. I get a kick out of it, and it gets my confidence in a perfect place to go on and deal with my difficult week ahead. Every man should play against people he can dominate. It's like that HBO show Westworld. I can go in there and do whatever the hell I want. And Bill Russell did the same thing. He was playing in a fantasy league. Yes, Bill Russell never lost a Game 7 or a title game in his career, which means when the money was on the line in high school, college, the Olympics, and Pro Bowl, Bill Russell never lost. Fantastic! And holy shit! But by Game 7, everyone he was playing against was fucking tired from working their second jobs. You try playing defense against Bill Russell after a full day of selling life insurance door to door. In his rookie season, Russell led the Celtics to the first of his 11 NBA titles. An untouchable record that doesn't even sound possible. Something for the ages. A record to this day that shocks fans and statisticians. Also, a record achieved while playing against slow, white, bad-kneed men in a non-integrated league where each team only had 2 black players. Come on, Bill, was it that tough? Mr. Russell led his Celtics to the promised land by conquering the Syracuse Nationals in the Eastern Conference Finals. The Nats scorer was Hall of Famer Dolph Schayes. There's no weak men named Dolph in this world. That's a fact. Just look at Dolph Lundgren. He fought Rocky and ran around the gym shredded with no fat while on steroids and racism, ready to take on America. But If Dolph Schayes was guarding Bill Russell, then Bill Russell was going to score a lot of points. Dolph Schayes was 6'7", full of gorgeous, thick hair, and he was Jewish. Bill Russell was 6'10", 220 pounds of solid rock, lean, mean athlete. Dolph Schayes was 195 pounds of matzo ball soup. You don't cover Bill Russell when every Sunday you're knee-deep in bagels and smoked salmon. It's too much. No Jewish man could handle that. Of course Russell's going to pull down 31 rebounds a game against this giant Jew. Bill moved him out of the way while Dolph thought about going to med school or working in the garment district. Either was fine with him. He knew the deal. It wasn't a fair matchup at all. Bill Russell led the Celtics in his rookie season to a championship, and the entire thing culminated in a tough Game 7 with the now famous Coleman play. A play that defined Bill Russell as the dominating defensive center of his era, an era rarely caught on tape, which helps in myth-making. In fact, many of the NBA's greatest moments weren't even preserved on film, TV, or even snapshots. I mean, Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game? I believed it happened, but it has crossed my mind that the whole fucking thing was made up since no one can seem to find it. During Game 7 of those finals, and I quote, Russell ran down Hawks guard Jack Coleman, who received an outlet pass at midcourt, and Russell blocked his shot despite the fact that Russell had been standing at his own baseline when the ball was thrown to Coleman. That block preserved Boston's slim 103-102 lead with 40-odd seconds left to play in regulation, saving the game for the Boston Celtics. Sounds outstanding, right? Sounds amazing. Sounds like someone made a fucking mistake. How the hell do you get from baseline to center court on an inbound? Are you a fucking superhero? Are you the fastest man on the planet? Or are you a figment of a sports writer's imagination? They're making it sound like LeBron's block against Andre Iguodala in Game 7 of the 2016 NBA Finals. And it doesn't make sense in reality. Please, please, do me a favor. Take a look at Jack fucking Coleman. Look him up right now online. Does he look anything like Andre fucking Iguodala? Iguodala was in the 2006 dunk contest and has a highlight reel that would make the late, great Daryl Dawkins blush from the planet Lovetron. And Jack Coleman looked like he wanted to get home for cheesecake and television. So please, stop making these guys out to be gods. Bill Russell simply wasn't the greatest player of all time. He just happened to be the greatest player of his time. Just so we're clear, I'm Jewish, I'm a Jewish athlete, and if you think I was hating on Jewish athletes in the Bill Russell piece, you could not be more wrong. Dolph Schayes and the athletic Jews of yesteryear. First of all, Dolph Schayes was a Hall of Fame player and one of the many great Jewish athletes from back in the days. There ain't no hate here. I love my people. The Jews have made some great accomplishments in sports. You think I don't know about the Sandy Koufaxes of the world and the Hank Greenbergs in baseball? You think that I don't know that there were amazing Jewish boxers in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even 60s who fought for world championships like Barney Ross and Benny Leonard? I know all about it. But we had our day, and it's over. I'm sure one day there will be some Jewish freak of nature who will come along and shock the community and even the world. I know that's a possibility. But please, just accept things the way they are now. It's over for us in pro sports. And I will die in peace never seeing a Jewish tight end starting in the NFL, and that's okay. Why did it stop? Because as scrappy and determined as my people are, we just ain't built for high-level competitive sports anymore. And that's a 100% unchecked fact. Listen, once sports became fully integrated, things came to an abrupt end for the Hebes, and it's fine. The chosen people, we had a good run. But it was just that. A run. Now let it go. Look around. And when was the last time you heard, and the gold medal for the 200-yard sprint goes to Aaron Schwartzberg? It doesn't happen. It's never going to happen. The film White Men Can't Jump should have just been called Jewish Men Are Slow As Fuck, Can't Jump, and Neither Can Gentiles, but they have a few exceptions. That's a little too long for a title, but I'm sure they'd consider it if the movie came out today. So I'm not hating on Dolph Schayes. In fact, I know personally that he was a very good man. In 1982, I attended Dolph Shays basketball camp in upstate New York. And even though I was threatened with being thrown out 4 days into the camp for disciplinary reasons, Mr. Shays took me aside and gave me a very fair talking to. He suggested that I play with the older kids to keep me in line and ultimately kept me in the camp for the entire 7 days despite my counselor's constant attempts to throw me out. They also teased me by calling me rap-a-crap the entire session. It hurt. It hurt bad. It was an emotional summer, but Mr. Shays spoke to me like a Jewish giant grandfather, something I really needed at the time. Michael, everything about your behavior this week says you should be thrown out. Thanks, Coach. Michael, this isn't a sentence that requires a thank you. This is me telling you that you should be thrown out of here and your behavior needs to change. Oh, no thanks. It just means you need to straighten up and fly right, kid. You're not paying any attention at the camp, and you're running into other people's cabins yelling random things like a mashugana. I'm sorry, Mr. Shays. I'll stop. I promise. I love basketball. Well, no one cares about that. Just take a breath, Michael. Okay. Get it together, Michael. You have great potential. Oh, that means a lot. You know, basketball is everything to me. Well, I didn't mean it basketball. But basketball is not in your future, Michael. It's not? No, it's not. You're heavy-footed and you don't have the patience to learn the game. Well, what am I supposed to do? Well, let's start with paying attention to the counselors and coaches when they talk to you. I don't know. I don't know about this, Mr. Shays. I do. Trust me. I see the good in you, Michael. Thanks. Even if I'm the only one here who sees it. Shit, man. That's a true story. No bullshit. Dolph Shays had my back in 1982 when no one else did. And I always appreciated it. Watching my man Allen Iverson play hoops was like watching Jackson Pollock paint. Crazy energy, flailing all over the fucking room, knocking shit over, falling down, half bleeding, sweating, and putting every ounce of his soul on the line every night. And when it was over, you know you witnessed a thing of fucking beauty and you were emotionally exhausted. That is what a real artist does. Moves the shit out of you. Of course, there were stronger, faster, bigger, more skilled players, better shooters, sharper passers, and all around more talented players and all that other bullshit. But he was the motherfucking king of self-expression. I'm talking about laying it on the line every time he hit the floor and painting the picture that was running through his veins, leaving everything he had on the court. The same way a great artist leaves it on the canvas or a great rapper like Tupac left it on the track. You know, I don't get moved by much these days, but a few years ago when my lady forced me to go to the Museum of Modern Art against my will for a Picasso exhibit called The Weeping Women, my first thought while checking out Pablo's work was fucking Allen Iverson is the Picasso of his shit. He's all AI all day. His heart and soul were all over the court, all over every single game he played. And AI was not concerned with what you thought. Real artists aren't. John Coltrane didn't ask you what note he was supposed to play when crafting a Love Supreme. He played what he felt and then you came along. Allen Iverson played his game, lived his way, and you either came along or you didn't. He gave no fucks what you thought, and he still played great. Iverson played in 11 straight All-Star games, was the 96th Rookie of the Year, number one in steals 2 years in a row, and averaged the most points per game in 4 seasons, all the while standing 6 feet tall, weighing 160 pounds, fully clothed with 3 pounds of jewelry, some Timberlands, and a do-rag on. Yeah, I know he drove his coaches batshit crazy and can shoot you in and out of a game in the same half. And I know the practice rant seemed off the wall, but he was always, always, always A to the fucking I. And let me be clear, I agreed with him on that stupid fucking practice rant. He was on TV during that press conference telling it exactly how it was. Practice? We in here talking about practice? I'm the franchise player, and we're talking about practice? This makes total sense to me. He went out every day, busted his ass on the court, put his body and life on the line, and you're asking him about practice? Half the game, he's about to crash onto the floor or flying into the stands for an out-of-bounds ball. And you're talking to Allen Iverson about fucking practice? He needed a few days rest. Plus, Iverson was your star, and you're asking about practice? Fuck you. It made total sense to me. Iverson had the looks, image, and swagger of a superstar. He carried himself like there was a red carpet under him at all times. I mean, he was on some real James Dean shit for real. And he should have been the face of the NBA. I mean, who else did they want? Steve Nash? No offense to my man Stevie Nash, but he looked like Kelly Leak, that burnout from the original Bad News Bears movie. But I also always felt like AI was just a genuinely shy person. He didn't want to talk to the press. And why should he? He's no debutante. He's not a gossip. So what? He liked to keep it a little bit close to the vest when speaking to the press. He just never seemed comfortable with it the way LeBron and Magic did when it came to talking to the press. And he made no apologies for it. He was just being himself to the power of 10 all the time. I remember the press was on AI because he said, "Some days I don't feel like going to shoot around. I don't even feel like playing basketball all day." And the headlines read that he wasn't grateful to be a pro and he didn't care about his team and all sorts of other bullshit. But he was telling it like it is, the fucking truth. You think anyone likes working at whatever job they do every single fucking day? I don't give a shit if your job is tasting candy. You're not gonna love it every day. And as much as AI loved playing basketball, it's still a job. I mean, who the hell loves their job every single day? No one. I have a cool job, and of course I love what I do. But there's days when I'd rather be at home on the couch with a case of Snapple, drowning myself in processed sugar. Yeah, it happens. It's natural. I don't care if you're in the NBA, NFL, NHL, MLB, CFL, the Rolling Stones, or fucking Coldplay. I don't know why the hell I threw Coldplay in there. They seem happy all the time. I mean, let a man express the way he feels and move on. Allen Iverson's honesty bothered you? Too fucking bad. He went hard when he went to work, and that should have been all that mattered. Iverson wasn't the best shooter. His form was not perfect. And sure, when he passed, sometimes it felt like he was doing it reluctantly, as if to say, "Here, man, take the ball, but you know I'd rather be shooting it." He was one of the best ball handlers ever, but not the best. His shot selection was way off at times, but so the fuck what? He attacked and attacked and kept coming relentlessly. All art, all day, all guts, all soul. He went harder on the floor than anybody, every game, every possession, and you felt it, and we all loved it. I don't give a shit. You can teach and improve shooting, passing, and defensive footwork all you want, but you cannot teach that inner drive to kick fucking ass every play of every single game. You can't teach toughness. You can't learn that kind of thing. There's no class for getting the shit knocked out of your 160-pound body and hopping up and going right back at it all the while you're breathing. That's something you're fucking born with. I know Michael Jordan was a savage and Larry Bird was a cold-blooded killer and Kobe wanted to step on your throat, but watching Allen Iverson attack was like seeing a live fucking personal statement. He came out skipping up and down in the warm-ups, getting his me-against-the-world mentality going in his head. Thrashing his body come game time, crashing on the floor, falling out of bounds, smashing into the stands, and then walking away, headband tight, cornrow set, the MVP of the game. Watching Allen Iverson play told you everything you needed to know about him as a person. You could literally feel his heartbeat. You could feel his pain when he lost and his joy when he was winning. Watching Iverson play articulated the beauty, pain, chaos, and the struggle that made him a true artist on the basketball court. Thank you, my man. Watching you play made me feel alive every single time. And that is what great art is supposed to do. The Michael Rappaport Celebrity Scouting Report, Volume 1. Okay, I get it. By now, I'm sure a lot of you are saying to yourselves, "Rappaport, you're talking an awful lot of shit about pro athletes. Does it have anything to do with the fact that you'll never become a pro athlete, Michael Rappaport?" No, it doesn't. But if it bothers you, then let's take a little break and talk some shit about people I actually know and have played against. So here you have it. The very first Michael Rappaport Celebrity Scouting Report, or celebrities who think they can ball. Number one, Common, my main man. One of the most respected and influential rappers to ever do it, a prolific actor, and one of the most well-rounded talents in our industry, and a guy who's never seen a jump shot he didn't like. He gives 100% of himself on the screen and shoots 100% of the time he has the ball. My man Common was unbelievable in the film Just Right as a pro basketball player, but something tells me passing was not in the script. When he's not shooting a flick or a TV show, he's shooting the rock whether he's open or not. I've been open and in front of my man Common for 6 straight years, my man, and I've never seen a ball near me. I'm open, man. Pass me the fucking rock, please. I mean, maybe it was the incident that made him that way. If you don't know about the incident, allow me. It was the 2011 Celebrity All-Star Game, and our team was playing Justin Bieber. I called a quick pregame huddle and told my squad, do not, under any circumstances, let Bieber cross you over or make you look bad, because the public will not let you forget about it and your friends and family will never live it down. I said that. I said those exact words. I even said, foul that Canadian jackrabbit if you have to, but do not let him make you look bad. Well, when we came out of the first timeout, Common reached out to D up the frail pop icon and got crossed the fuck over. Ankles broken and straight shook the fuck up by the pop singer. Common took it on the chin and went on to do enough quality work that the incident is rarely, if ever, brought up. And I'm sorry for bringing it up now, my man, but pass me the fucking ball. Next up, Justin Bieber. Small, scrappy, unpredictable, and Canadian. He makes great use of his dancing feet as well. I played against Bieber in that 2011 Celebrity All-Star Game where I was trying to go back-to-back as the MVP. But it just wasn't meant to be. That year I actually had a toe issue that I never brought up. Bieber was quicker and more competitive than I expected, but made countless unnecessary moves showing off for the screaming girls that showed up to watch him play. He dribbled between his legs when no one was even checking him and went behind the back twice while standing there alone. I have to admit, he took a few hard fouls from me and handled it like a champ. He popped right off the floor like a backup singer who danced during a Grammy performance and was not going to be embarrassed. Bieber took home the MVP that year. Good shit, bro, but I'll be back. A yay yay? Ice Cube. What can I say? A top 5 or top 10 MC on anybody who knows anything about rap music's best of list. Rapper turned mogul, the brains of the operation, my co-star in Higher Learning, and he even threw me a dope cameo bone and Next Friday. However, he also rapped, Get Me on the Court and I'm Trouble, Last Week Fucked Around and Got a Triple-Double, in the classic song Good Day. Great fucking lyric, Cube, but kinda sorta hard to believe. Now, Cube can legit play, do not get it twisted. However, I have balled with Ice Cube, and I need to see some tape of this alleged triple-double. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying I wouldn't mind an eyewitness or some verbal proof that the shit even happened in the first place and that triple-double didn't just rhyme with the word trouble. I mean, Ice Cube really does have a tricky old-school game. He's not shy about calling for the ball or shooting the rock, and he will absolutely run down court before seeing if it even goes in the hoop. Sometimes his confidence sort of outweighs his ability, but if everything I touch turned to gold, platinum, and box office bonanzas, I'd be sort of confident too. Tobey fucking Maguire. Solid actor, but his competitive nature does not match his skill set. He goes hard on every single play. I'm just not sure where the fuck he's going. He nearly kills himself and everyone in his path with or without the ball. Tobey Maguire plays hoops like he's running from a fire and isn't sure who to tell about it. Frantic, rolling around on the ground for loose balls and periodically diving for the ball when it's not there. Hyper-competitiveness does work to his advantage. If you like scrappy, reckless, out-of-control abandon, you want him on your squad. But not for long. Adam Sandler. Adam Sandler, I gotta tell you about him. Adam Sandler is a passively aggressive, oddly deceiving basketball player. He's got the same game as the old guy on the court with the high black socks above the calf and the gym teacher nut huggers from the 70s. Sandler looks like everyone's uncle who can't play, but then will bury you with 20 points without sweating. He's got a great Jewish low center of gravity mixed with slow feet that somehow, some way, find the perfect position to score. I'm sure his thousands of hours of on-set lunch break basketball games have paid off. He's got a true blue box-out kind of ass and an uncanny knack for making passes that look fucked up when they leave your hands, but somehow find their way. Brian McKnight, Grammy award-winning singer who can croon a girl's panties off, trick her into liking you, and then dunk it on her brother. McKnight can shoot the lights out from three-point land, and the release looks as smooth as he sounds. He also has an impressive ability to take it to the hole and go hard. I'm telling you, he drove by me once and whispered some R&B Isaac Hayes shit to me. He crossed me over, and all I heard was, "I didn't want to do that to you, Michael, but I had to." However, Brian McKnight is another fucking ball hawk. That solo artist life got you forgetting about good old-fashioned team ball, my man. Drake can't play fucking basketball, but he's a big fan. Rap skills are solid, the voice is original, the dedication to the craft is strong, but he shot a fucking air ball during warm-ups for a Kentucky Wildcat game, and I can't let that slide. Drake's game is fast and slow at the same time. His hands move fast while his feet go slow. Hey, it's tough to explain. It must be some Canadian post-bar mitzvah shit. Kanye West. Yeezus rented out the entire fucking Staples Center for his birthday and the shit backfired. All reports have Justin Bieber winning the MVP once again that day, and my sources tell me that Kanye wasn't happy about it. Kanye's game is all shoulders and sprinting for no reason. His inability to find the open man has more to do with him not looking than it does with his passing skills. No reports, videos, or cell phone footage can be found of the day Bieber stole Yeezy's B-Day MVP away from him. Will Ferrell. Will Ferrell is too funny and too talented to take seriously when you're playing basketball with him. He's got an amazing center of gravity and a strange amount of athleticism from a body that doesn't scream sports, and the low post game is bafflingly solid. He's hands down the funniest athlete in the world, and he's nearly impossible to defend due to laughter. Every single time you see him play feels like an SNL skit. He uses his humor on offense and defense, which gives him a well-rounded, hilarious game. Leonardo DiCaprio. Number one on my all-time great stickman list, so it irks me that he's also got a pretty solid post-up game he developed while training for the Basketball Diaries. His expensive trainer taught him a pivot spin move that he still uses 15 years later that's tough to defend. DiCaprio's got long arms, and when it looks like he's nowhere near you, somehow or another, he's hand-checking you. But thank God his jump shot is absolutely non-existent, otherwise he'd be too perfect a human being. Mark Wahlberg. The artist formerly known as Marky Mark, excellent actor, real deal media mogul, could run for office at this point. But he should take some time off from playing hoop. Mark's got speed, agility, and strength, but they all belong in rugby, football, or street fight. The finesse game is not his thing. And he's been known around town to call suspect fouls that are still being talked about today in celebrity circles. I played with him during the Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch days, and there ain't one thing funky about his basketball skill set. However, Wahlberg's work ethic is undeniable, so you can never count him out. Kevin Hart, you motherfucker, you. This is my man, 50 grand. I love this motherfucker. He once had fantastic speed and incredible athleticism. Unfortunately, now both are gone and have been replaced with humor and wealth. This Philadelphia native at one point had an all-around aggressive game equipped with handles and lockdown defense. K. Hart was impressive at 5'6 with no fear of driving the lane with the big boys of basic, normal height. I hate to say it, but Father Time has stolen both the quickness and his vertical. It may be that he's weighted down by massive box office receipts and millions of dollars in cash, but the facts are the facts, and the days of lightning quickness and fearless drives are behind him. So congratulations on being the new king of comedy, but now you and I are the same speed, so I'll see your little ass when I see you. Queen Latifah. I gotta tell you right now, the Queen's game is no joke. She's not afraid to mix it up with the mere mortals and bang in the paint. Latifah goes hard with either hand and will have you scratching your head and confused by her fadeaway. It's original, and it looks like she's falling down backwards, but she's actually fading away. And if she shows up in a ponytail, you're done. She's not one for talking trash. I've seen her get 23 points and leave without talking to anyone before, after, or during the game. The Queen can play ball. Fucking Woody Harrelson. White men can't jump in real life either. I used to play with him a bunch. He's scrappy and his jump shot is disjointed, but somehow finds the basket. Woody looks like he's tripping over a fucking curb when he shoots. It's impossible to block his shot because even he doesn't know where the fuck he's releasing it from. Loves to talk shit and won't back down. He's got strangely strong calves, but his finger roll at the net isn't as good as his joint rolling skills on the bus. Wood Harris. The Wire's Avon Barksdale is legit on the court and has a shit-talking game that's easily on par with his acting game. He's got oversized Dr. J hands that seem too big for his body, and those are his greatest basketball playing asset. I've seen him dunk on fellow SAG and DGA members with odd slow motion yet incredibly impressive one-handed slams that left union members stunned and upset about their own game. Nick Cannon, this motherfucker, multi-talented TV mogul and an underrated stick man. Nick can play almost as well as he dresses. Shows up to the game wearing some colorful crazy shit. Crazy outfits, crazy hairdos, crazy fucking shoes, and a crazy fucking game. He does have a solid fadeaway, but he's lazy on defense. On defense, he looks like he's thinking about hosting another TV show. I'm gonna tell you straight up, Nick Cannon has way too many jobs to be great at hoops. Looks the part, but he ain't shit. I'll tell him to his face, I love you, Nick, but you ain't shit. George Clooney. This is a sore spot. I once lost a best of 3-on-3 one-on-one series to George Clooney on his personal Warner Brothers basketball court during his days on ER. But I will say this, I was off that day and I did not eat breakfast earlier that morning. Questionable calls were made, but I must say he won fair and pretty much square. George Clooney's game is confusing because he will foul the fuck out of you, talk shit, then be friendly. It's a real mindfuck. Also, in my defense, George at the time was making $1 million an episode. And fear of injuring him hampered my usually aggressive style that would have locked his ass down. Plus, I just didn't want to scar the face of the sexiest man alive. He was actually the sexiest man alive. I didn't want to ruin that for people. I will say this, though. Something about him being so handsome and sweating on me, it kind of took my mind off the game. That fucker beat me 2 out of 3 games and went on talk shows and bragged about it. My street cred hasn't been the same since. Breckenmeyer. Good actor. He's got a short, fiery game and does an uncomfortable amount of running around. The guy never stops moving, even in a half-court game. I guarantee you he's running around somewhere right now just for the hell of it. I promise you. Sacha Baron Cohen. You know who that is, right? Borat? This fucking guy is funny as shit, but unfortunately, hoops just ain't his thing. His post-up game is confusing because he's tall and in position. It looks like he's completely lost. But he's such a nice guy, I feel bad that athletics didn't make it into his genes. Superman, Dean Cain. Superman can fucking ball. He's heavy-handed and big-bodied when he's thinned out. Cain's got a legit jumper and can run the point if he has to. Great court vision, and his hair is fucking amazing. Denzel Washington. Fucking Denzel. I balled against him years ago at the YMCA, and he always brought his outdoor game indoors. Behind-the-back passes, long-range jumpers, followed by a lot of shit-talking. He has a well-rounded-out, overall impressive game. He's oddly strong, and I could see why he's always breaking shit in every movie he does. He plays basketball like he's always on the verge of breaking some shit and pushing you down. Denzel's the type of motherfucker where it's like just too perfect. He's good at basketball, ridiculous at acting, just too perfect. Jaleel White. Remember him? Urkel? Urkel can ball for real. Urkel's got handles, a good fadeaway, tight jumper, never hogs the rock, but the fact that he was Urkel fucked a lot of people's heads up on the parquet floor, especially when he was talking shit. Getting your ass bust by Urkel and having him talk shit to you is something you will never forget. Shout out to my man Jaleel White. Will Smith, the fucking Fresh Prince, great dude, solid game, yet lacks a little speed. Respectable Philadelphia street game, hates playing defense, but has a deceptively strong lower body. I will say this, his win was suspect until he did the movie Ali. After the movie Ali, the Fresh Prince is too rich and too famous to play in public, so there are no up-to-date scouting reports on him. That's it. This is the facts as I saw him over the years playing ball with all you guys in Hollywood. You want to play me, you know where to find me. Games 11, my ball. Let's go. Hashtag mad shaming. Mad shaming. Verb. When a person tries to cover up feelings of being pissed the fuck off to avoid shame of showing anger in public. Mad shaming. One of the best and most scandalous examples of public mad shaming was when the Seattle Seahawks beat the New England Patriots in 2013. And first ballot shit-talking Hall of Famer Richard Sherman ran over to Tom Brady and asked this question. You mad, bro? You mad? And Tom Brady didn't respond. Not a word. But you could see on his face what Tom was thinking. He was thinking, yeah, you fuck. Of course I'm mad. We lost. I just played like shit. And your dumbass intercepted me. And now you're running over with some passive-aggressive bullshit asking me if I'm mad. Yeah, I'm fucking mad, bro. I'm really fucking mad. Now take a walk, fuck nuts, before I smack one of those dreads off your head, bro. Now it's very well documented that I can't stand Tom fucking Brady. But in that moment, I was 100% on his side. Because that you mad, bro, you mad from Richard Sherman was straight up mad shaming. It was captured on camera and laid out in very basic terms. Tom Brady did not want to articulate his true feelings of anger and frustration because of his fear of showing feelings in public. So consequently, he was very publicly and very mercilessly mad shamed. That Richard Sherman mad shaming incident was replayed over and over for weeks on sports shows. It became its own hashtag, hashtag you mad bro. And someone even opened up an at you mad bro account on Twitter. Am I mad bro? You bet your fucking sweet ass I'm mad, prick lips. But fuck if I'm gonna show it to you right now. Why, I ask. Why not show it? Why not get mad? Go ahead, get mad, get real mad, and embrace it, people. This mad shaming needs to stop now. Anger is great. It's natural. I feel it right now for no reason at all. Being mad is fantastic, and being mad shamed is not okay. Plus, it has deep ramifications on its victims in ways only well-trained doctors can diagnose. It's embarrassing, regrettable, terrible for your health, and above all, it's downright shameful. Embrace your anger. Embrace your madness. And stand up against mad shaming and let the tiger roar. Let the lion out. And if the bear is poked, go ahead and say fuck it. And let the bear take a swipe. Stop holding it all in. That's what causes bad behavior in the outside world, not to mention chronic diarrhea. And mad shaming is beyond sports. It's happening every day in schools, in the workplace, and in the home. We're all so afraid to show our anger out of fear of people pointing and taunting and saying passive-aggressive shit like, wow, are you getting upset, dude? Guess what? Yeah, motherfucker, I'm getting upset. I'm even more upset at the fact that I can't show how upset I am. And it's about to manifest itself later in the day, and I'm going to take it out on someone who doesn't deserve it. So yeah, I am upset, dude. And I'm getting even more upset that you're asking me if I'm getting upset with that Rob Lowe peaceful-looking resting smirk on your face. And no disrespect to Rob Lowe, but he knows that that fucking silly-looking smirk can drive a motherfucker crazy if he just stared at you and was asking if you were upset. But shout out to Rob Lowe's skin lotion. My man looks good for being 3,000 years old. But that is not the point. I digress. The entire Incredible Hulk series was based on mad shaming. That poor prick David Banner couldn't feel anger. And if he did, he turned into a giant green beast that whooped the fuck out of everyone in sight. If he could have just felt his anger and expressed it, he wouldn't have had to turn green and turn into Lou Ferrigno and have us act like it was the same guy. Now, I don't want you people to forget that mad shaming is the cousin of hate shaming. Every day, you hear people question variations of hating. Why you hating? Are you a hater? Or don't hate? I strongly believe that you can't truly love if you can't truly hate. And hating in sports is healthy. Hating in sports is essential. Being a fan of competitive sports is one of the only places that I think some good old-fashioned healthy hate should be embraced and encouraged. Now you want to humiliate people because of their organic, God-given hate? You want to take that away from people? You want to dishonor and disgrace people because of this? No! Stop it! Stop it now! Stop it right fucking now! It's an enormous part of sports! Maybe one of my favorites! Saying don't hate in sports is like saying don't love! You can't love if you don't hate! It's simple mathematics! Ask the Dalai Lama! He started out as a hater, or one of those guys did before they started walking around in those nice-looking robes, loving everyone, and half-smiling. Those Shaolin monks were violent haters until they went the way of the peaceful warrior. Look it up. I don't know if that's actually true, but I'm in the flow and I don't fact-check. Okay, but I wouldn't dare attempt to stop a Boston Red Sox fan from hating Bucky Dent. You should hate him. Never would I talk shit to a pissed-off, swollen-faced Boston Red Sox fan and say some punk-ass hate-shaming shit like, why are you hating on Bucky Dent? Don't be mad that New York Yankee Bucky Dent hit that looping home run over that dingy-ass green monster in that hellhole that you call Fenway Park. I know exactly why all loathing Boston Red Sox fans hate the Buckster. And I would never take that away from even the most venomous low-life Boston Red Sox fan while he's sauced up and crying about his team. I get it. I totally understand. It's the same reason why I hate that cockeyed bastard David Ortiz. Who can hate the lovable Big Poppy? Me, that's who. Oh, and every single Yankee fan that's alive. But it's okay. Sports lovers love to hate. It's in our blood. Of course we respect that fat motherfucker, but we also hate that motherfucker. We have to, and it makes perfect sense. Respecting and hating have nothing and everything to do with each other. I don't hate any lames. We only hate the greats. You think I spent time loving Michael fucking Jordan during his career? Hell no. Of course I knew he was the best player ever, and I stayed up late to watch his highlights on every news channel every single game of his career. And of course I loved and wore his sneakers like the rest of the world. But that was all before he became a real fucking issue for me. Once he started kicking the New York Knicks asses, it was all over. All of it. Down went the Jordan posters on my wall right into the fucking garbage chute. No more running around New York City to buy overpriced Michael Jordan shoes, and no more humming, be like Mike, be like Mike. I didn't want to be like Mike. I wanted to bury Mike. I hated that fuck. I despised him. I was blinded by hate, disgust, and anger. And I didn't cheer for MJ when he came back to the Garden in 1995 and dropped 55 points on us. I was pissed off, and I know for damn sure that Jordan loved the hate. It made him great. The greats embraced the hate. Reggie Miller lived off visceral, raging hate from fans in every arena and every city. He would drink hate smoothies for breakfast. He ate, drank, and shat hate sandwiches. But without that hate, Reggie Miller doesn't make into the Hall of Fame. Reggie the fuck Miller would never question fans about being angry towards him. It was his fuel and his fire. I could not stand that snaggletooth cocksucker. A few years after Reggie retired, I saw him in a restaurant in New York City and I walked over to him. And before I could say anything, he said to me, "You ready to give it up? You ready to stop hating, stop talking shit?" And it wasn't at all mean or confrontational. He had seen me at games over the years heckling, and I knew that he knew that I hated his fucking guts throughout his career. Now, he was asking me if I was ready to put down my hate sword and treat him with normal person-to-person respect. And I told him straight up, "Reggie, I hated you to death, but I respected you even more. We gave each other a pound, and that was it. Now when I see him around NBA games, it's all love. But we both know that old hate never fades." And Joe Montana, he killed the fucking Giants game after game, and I hated him and his fucking amazing hair and his dimples. And that goofy-ass, Stretch Armstrong-looking motherfucker Randy Johnson taking away the Yankees World Series in 2001. the hate and disgust I felt toward him was real and vital, and if I saw him today, it would be tough not to say something. That guy stole months of my happiness, and it stung. But guess what? It's okay. It's what makes sports so damn entertaining and such an amazing escape. We get to feel it all, and it is okay. So the next time somebody else is screaming and yelling with snot coming out of their nose because their favorite player or their favorite team took a tough loss, sit back and let them go through the natural progressions of being mad as fuck, and let them hate as hard as they need to until it passes, naturally. It's just nature taking its course. Embrace the hate. Question time for Bill Belichick. Bill Belichick. What can I say, Billy boy? I don't like you. I don't like your face. I actually find it quite unsettling. I don't like your disposition, and I don't like the way you've carried yourself for all these years in the NFL, Bill. And I know that you're the winningest coach of all time, but I think you're 500% full of caca. Yes, and I'm sure most of you reading this know that I'm not a New England Patriots fan. And the easy way out is to assume that my dislike of Billy Bullshit is due to jealousy of the fantastic football team that he coaches. However, that is an incorrect assumption regardless of the fact that I am a homegrown New York Giants fan. Yes, we haven't had the undisputable success of the New England Patriots, but I still rejoice, usually during a solid and healthy bowel movement, over the fact that the Giants did two fantastic Super Bowl stuff jobs on those New England Patriots. Yes, we stuffed them nice, and they stuffed them real proper on the biggest stage in all of sports. Let's take a quick trip down memory lane in case you forgot. The year was 2008. And the game was Super Bowl XLII, which I think means Super Bowl 42. But to be honest, I had to look up what the fuck XLII equals in real world numbers. I don't know why the fuck the NFL continues this Roman numeral charade. But this ain't Game of Thrones, so cut the crap. Everyone is lost and Googling the Roman numerals to figure out what fucking Super Bowl we're talking about. However, I digress. Let's refocus. 2008. The New England Patriots were being considered the greatest football team ever, and they were so close to completing a perfect 19-0 season. Wouldn't that have been delightful? They would have been the first team to pull it off since the 1972 Miami Dolphins. Wouldn't that have been a grand accomplishment? Well, it didn't happen, fuckos. The Giants came into this Super Bowl a huge underdog. They fought their way into the big dance, and they made it, tattered and torn. New England was up 14-10 at halftime. However, New York stayed alive and got the ball back with almost 2 minutes to go when Giants quarterback, the funny-faced, goofy-looking, yet stellar Eli Manning, escaped the menacing grip of six or seven Patriot defenders. Baby-faced Eli got loose and threw a duck to David Tyree. The relatively unknown Tyree made a magical catch, pinning the ball to his helmet. He looked as shocked as the rest of the world. I, for one, jumped on my couch, took my shirt off, scared the shit out of both my sons, and said, "What the fuck? What the fuck?" I doubt any Patriots fans jumped on their couches during that magical moment, but I bet you flipped them over, didn't you? Yeah. On the very next play, the Giants quarterback, with the inability to grow facial hair, threw an easy touchdown pass to a wide-open Giants receiver named Plaxico Burress. To this day, I still can't figure out how and why Plaxico Burress was so wide open. I think it was because the Patriots were still in shock from the David Tyree once-in-a-lifetime earmuff catch. Eli Manning was named MVP of the game. And I would bet most gamblers would have expected the staggeringly handsome man of steel and hair-gelled Tom Brady to be the MVP. But he wasn't. Sorry, Tommy. The Giants won that Super Bowl 17-14, and the Patriots' dreams of being considered the greatest team ever went right down the fucking drain. It was gorgeous. And just in case you forgot, the Giants also beat the Patriots in Super Bowl XLVI, which I think means 46, but who the hell knows? I left my Roman numeral translator at home again. The Giants got to the 2012 Super Bowl with the worst record a team ever had at 9-7. Madonna was the halftime guest of honor, and she flip-flopped around on stage half-naked while hanging on for dear life in 4-inch heels. I distinctly remember staring at the TV praying she didn't tear a meniscus or tweak a hammy during that performance. It wasn't a very memorable Super Bowl game. However, Eli did get a chance to play hero again, and he did. He threw a pin-perfect pass to Mario Manningham that left the Patriots and their fans in shock and awe. The Giants soon scored what would turn out to be the game-winning touchdown. But the Giants' Super Bowl victory was embarrassingly overshadowed by Leonardo DiCaprio's ex-girlfriend and Tom Brady's current wife Giselle throwing a post-game shit fit and broken English about Brady's wide receivers dropping catches. It was some low-brow TMZ shit, but a great moment for all of us Giants fans. So, like I said, I'm good with where the G-men stand versus the Patriots. It's Bill Belichick and his attitude I want to talk about. Billy, Billy, Billy. I know I'm not alone. I have a few questions, and I want some answers. What has crawled up that dusty ass of yours and died, Bill? Why all the one-word answers all the time? That robotic Raymond, I'm just here to coach football. I'm just here to coach football. Act is tired. It's also rude. You make San Antonio Spurs coach Greg Popovich look like the life of the party. You know how hard that is to do? For the last 17 years, every single time you show up at a press conference, you've been bad-mannered and impolite to every reporter. You treat every question like it's the dumbest question you ever heard. Don't you know that the only dumb question is the one you don't ask, Bill? You're question-shaming these innocent reporters day after day, week after week, season after season. You're making reporters feel bad about themselves. We get it. You're not a people person. You're a pro football coach. You're just there to do your job. Yeah. Bullshit. Those reporters you give reluctant, mumbled, rude, one-word answers to are also there to do their jobs. I have been trying to get an NFL-approved press pass so I could show up at your press conferences and ask you some questions myself. Thus far, for some reason, my press passes have been flat out denied. However, if I ever do get that press lanyard, here are some of the questions you could expect from me. Number one, the great Vince Lombardi, legendary leader of men, would show up to games looking sharp and presentable, wearing press suit and tie and that classy wool hat that yelled, "Dapper leader." Why do you show up looking like you just escaped a methadone clinic? Do you not understand that people paid hard-earned money to see your successful team play football? Yet you're on the sidelines dressed in a dingy cut-off sweatshirt that appears to be ripped from a puppy's mouth? What the fuck, Bill? Do you own a suit or not? My second question. Do you have any suggestions for a good video camera and lens package? I'm planning on recording the practice of my son's arch-rival flag football team. They're a competitive team named the Jets. Could you suggest me a camera that assures me the best quality recording to study the Jets in hopes of beating them, despite the fact that I know recording another team's practice is both ethically and morally wrong? Something with a tight rack of focus to see all the play calling signals to assure my son's team of victory. I'm not saying you would ever do this, but hypothetically, just hypothetically, if you, Bill Belichick, were filming another team's practice, what kind of camera would you use? Finally, my last question is, have you gotten any handwritten letters from President Trump lately? If so, would you please tell us what those letters were about? I feel like these are all very reasonable and well thought out questions. I'm sure I wouldn't get any answers because Billy the Grumpole acts like he doesn't have to answer to anybody. Yeah, I'm not sure if you know about this, but there was this very famous mobster from New York City named Vinny the Chin Gigante who ran the infamous Genovese crime family. His claim to fame was that he walked around Greenwich Village and Little Italy dressed in a bathrobe, pajamas, and slippers, and he talked to himself when he knew people were watching. He did this to give the impression that he was mentally ill and harmless and not a threat instead of the dangerous, devious criminal that he was. Billy the Chin Belichick, I'm watching you. I'm not alone, and I'm waiting for my answers. hookers, pills, dwarfs, and the Las Vegas Raiders. The Oakland fucking Raiders mean a lot to professional football. They represent something to the game. They have fans that go to literal war for their team. They've bred real football characters and villains in their time.